Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Joe, you got to change that thank you for believing us at the end, because they haven't given yet. Once they give, we believe in them. But we are broadcasting live. This is The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. In studio is Joe Galarraga, if you're still awake. Joe, hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Didn't fall asleep yet?
Not yet.
Well, congratulations on your membership drive. I've already signed up two people this weekend. I want to also thank Hearst Ranch for sponsoring us. It's funny, I'm reading about Ted Turner. That guy is an unbelievable conservationist, and people should look into what he has done to protect wild species in America. I mean, including bison, wolves, frogs, bats, grizzly bears, I mean, on and on and on. And as the second largest landowner in America, he has a lot of room to do this. He also owns a lot of property down near Patagonia in Argentina, I think that is. So what an interesting guy, conservationist. And I don't know that the sustainable food movement has really, you know, embraced him as a name. I never see him in the food section. I mean, the man owns 85 bison restaurants that, you know, all source bison from his properties. Pretty impressive. So this is going to be a great show today. We have Cal Elliott. Cal Elliott is a Michelin-starred chef and is the owner and founder of Rye Restaurant in Williamsburg. We also have Hadley Schmidt, who is the executive chef of Northern Spy Food Company. So really happy that you guys are giving up the enviable brunch shift and spending some time with us. Cal, tell us about the neighborhood where Rye opened then and now. I mean, I know it opened in 2009, and a lot has changed.
Williamsburg has become kind of a mecca for young people, I guess. I moved there in 1993, and when I moved there, you couldn't, I mean, everybody just worked in the city. There weren't any restaurants. I mean, you just kept your head down, and it was convenient because it was 5 minutes from the city, but there's definitely nothing going on. And here we are 20 years later, and, you know, you see Japanese tourists on the street and Europeans everywhere, and it's exciting.
Yeah, back in the day, it was just Peter Luger. I mean, that was the only time my mom ever took me across the bridge for food. So you opened Williamsburg in 09, and were you the only restaurant, you know, or were there still old Italian restaurants, like Red and White Tablecloth type restaurants, or where did people go to for food in that neighborhood?
Well, there was Bamonti's, which has always been there. It's the old Italian restaurant on Union. But we almost hit it a little late, actually. I've been cooking in the neighborhood for 10 years before I opened Rye, so you kind of saw it coming.
You were at Dumont and Dressler?
Yeah, and
those were kind of foundational places. So, I mean, did the neighborhood embrace you? I mean, how did you first get people? I mean, I know you weren't the only restaurant, but did you rely on reviews or just word of mouth?
I think just word of mouth. I mean, we're kind of on an off street anyway, so we're hard to find. Mm-hmm. So it makes it a little more difficult, but I think a little more rewarding when people actually find it and see, you know, that you put a lot of work into it.
It's a beautiful restaurant. I mean, really, really beautiful. I feel like I'm in a Western movie, like a John Wayne movie or something. But not even John Wayne, whoever's more elegant. It was very, it's very cool, old, dark wood. Everything made by hand. Really, really love it. So you are the first one, and that's tough. I mean, word of mouth slowly got you guys going. And then you fast forward to today, there are all these new restaurants there. I mean, is that good? I mean, are there just a shit ton more people hanging out now, and that's good for business?
Well, it's totally changed. When it used to be, you know, your Monday wasn't that different than your Saturday, and it was a real neighborhood vibe. You saw the same faces all the time. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew you. Everybody knew who you were. It was a real community, and now it's gotten a little saturated, and it's so competitive, and the customers have changed, and the people coming and opening businesses have changed. So it just feels like it's like a whole new world. You almost didn't know what you were getting yourself into. It's, you know, a lot of young people that have been there under 5 years, you know, and mm-hmm. Businesses that are banking on development. And so it's become very, very competitive, and everybody's your competition during the week. You know, the Chinese takeout places is your competition. And I think people eat differently. You know, Rye is a place where you go out to dinner, and I think people now, especially young people, go out to eat. You see a lot more communal seating. You see a lot of dining rooms that aren't that intimate, and a lot of great work in the kitchen. A lot of young chefs doing a lot of good things, but the dining room's kind of lost. And with the influx of young people in the neighborhood, I think that's been trying, and you really have to stick to your guns and try to, you know, the people that appreciate a nice atmosphere and a tablecloth and a server that is over 30.
Yeah, for sure. But I do say it's true, because you obviously put a lot of work in it, and we'll get to that. But when Erin and I, she's the executive director of the entire Heritage Radio Network. She's unbelievable energy. And we were going to have we had just finished Cut Pack, and we came to your restaurant. We didn't know what to expect. And then all of a sudden, when you walk in, we're like, oh, like, and I, you know, button my shirt here and was like, all right, so we're going to have a cocktail. There's going to be, you know, all of a sudden we were elevated by walking into that place. So Cal grew up in Idaho and spent much of his formative years working in Alaska as a commercial fisherman. It was there that he gained an appreciation for hard work and for the people who truly love their product and trade. So tell us about this. Was this like Deadliest Catch, or what were you fishing, and who was your crew?
Well, Alaska's like New York with restaurants and boats. I mean, there's a million different boats in Alaska, a million different fisheries. Being from Idaho wasn't that crazy idea to go up to Alaska. I mean, my greatest ambition was just to get out of Idaho, so Alaska was the quickest way to do it.
They're kind of connected, right? I mean, Idaho, Portland, I mean, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, those states kind of...
Yeah, I think Idaho, Oregon, and Washington State supply most of the workforce for Alaska.
Hmm.
But Alaska's crazy. It's a lot like New York City. You have people from all over the world going there and working, and, you know, Anchorage is probably, in the summertime, the craziest city in the United States. I mean, it's nuts.
What do people go there for? For work or for Wild West? Or?
I think they go there to get it, to get out of paying child support. But, yeah, I mean, I gillnetted salmon. I seined for salmon. I worked in Dutch Harbor, which is where all the crab boats go out of, and longline for a gray cod, or what they call Pacific cod. And those boats are, you know, larger catcher processors, more of what you would think of like fishing. But that's, you know, you're out for 40 days and it's pretty grueling, and it's not a great lifestyle.
So how does one go about getting their first gig out there? Do you just go to the port and you're kind of like a walk-on and you see which boat you like, or did you know of certain companies before you even got there and you seek those guys out?
Yeah, you can either go to the management companies in Seattle and get a job and you know, get sent up there, but then you're kind of signing your life away. You sign a contract. And
was that for like 6 months or?
Usually 90 days. If you don't fulfill your contract, you end up owing them money, because you have to. They pay for your airfare and they pay for your food, and you end up paying for fuel. So if you break your contract, you're in real trouble. And
So they're like headhunters almost. I mean, in a good. I mean, they find people and
They send them up
there. Put them in positions. Yeah.
And then, you know, the salmon fishing in Southeast Alaska and Bristol Bay is they're all small boats. There's a size requirement, so you can't go over 32 feet. And it's like basically a mom and pop restaurant. There's a lot of crews, a lot of different. You see the same people. It's like a little summer camp for fishermen, and you're fishing the you know the river. So you're fishing the mouth of the river, and you're always by land, and it's a good time.
Yeah, well, it can also get competitive because aren't you given a little strip, and when the salmon come on your little strip. You get those salmon, but if they go on the next guy's strip, and so there's a little jockeying for position.
Oh yeah, people, you think the restaurant business is competitive? Yeah, they basically what they call lace you. They lay their net right in front of your net, and you get you literally get a couple minutes to try to catch some fish. The tide pushes you back, and there's a boundary where you're not allowed to fish past. So mm-hmm. Everyone tries to lay their fish on the boundary. The tide pushes you back, so it's a constant just like running for position, trying to get. Your net in front, you get like 5 minutes, somebody puts their net in front of you, you pick your net up, pick all the fish as fast as you can, and get back out and try to get your net in the water again.
So when you first walked in as a complete rookie, what jobs did you get? And then as you grew in experience, and how long did you work there?
I was there 9 years.
So then by the ninth year, what kind of jobs were you doing versus what someone would do if they went there tomorrow?
The same job.
Same job.
Yeah, I mean, you just get maybe a higher percentage if you stand up for yourself. You get a little better at it. But yeah, you're a deckhand, so it's you're a deckhand.
And you're not an owner in the thing. So, is the owner usually the guy at the wheel?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's a management company. There's the guys that run the boat. You know, rarely do they own the boat. They're career fishermen, and they've been doing it, and they've worked their way up. They get their captain's license, mm-hmm. But. You know, the small boats, I don't even know what kind of license they let. A lot of crazy people just getting in the game in that thing. But, yeah, I worked for some crazy people up there, a lot of screamers, and very, you know, they didn't have a nice thing to say. I don't even think the guy I worked for 5 years knew my name. He was just, like, called me by, you know. Something that wasn't that pleasant.
Now, did you notice any change? I mean, this ecological thing. I mean, the guy who's actually out on the water. I mean, is bad stuff happening out there ecologically? And there's certain years that are like record lows, or I mean, is basically things pumping along.
I went up in '90 right after Valdez, so that was crazy. I mean, it put a lot of people to work. A lot of people had work, which is good for Alaska because those guys, you know, that winter there don't have much to do. Mm-hmm. But as far as salmon boats in most of Alaska, it's very regulated. So, when you go out on a big boat, there's basically a biologist there who's basically a fish cop, and he watches everything you bring on the boat.
He's like the USDA inspector for the meat house.
Exactly. So if we're fishing for cod and we bring up a halibut, we cut the halibut out, we cut the halibut loose. And longlining is very eco-friendly. There's almost no bycatch. You have that guy on the boat making sure that you're not doing anything crazy. Hmm. It's all baited hooks, so and those fish are incredibly resilient. So you're bringing them up. You're not bringing them up really quickly. Mm-hmm. All the fish are alive, and the ones that you're not fishing for, I mean, if you're fishing for cod, you just got to keep cod. You got to keep cod and skate. That's it.
Hmm. Very interesting. So does your time there influence the way you buy fish? I mean, do you know, because I always hear people, purveyors are nice and trustworthy depending on how fast their food spoils. So fish guys are the worst, meat guys are okay, and the nicest people, of course, are cheesemongers. My wife, they actually get better with age. But how does it change the way you buy fish? I mean, do you go to a fish place and be like, oh, that's not wild or?
Well, it just makes you frustrated because the prices for fish is so high, and like you said, the quality is hard to come by at all times. And you know, as a chef, especially of a small restaurant, when you when you pay the bills and you cook the food, it's it's painstaking. You try to keep a close eye on it. You try to talk to your fish purveyor. You try to see what's coming in nice. You have a constant relationship with them. And you know, fish is one of those things that you just you have to rotate it on the menu. You can't, it makes a lot of sense to put seasonal catch because, mm-hmm. They'll tell you straight up, like, yeah, we have it, but it's not looking good. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you don't want to be pigeonholed to, like, be serving one product. But, you know, the hardest thing is to educate the customer, the consumer, because I don't think they really understand that all the time.
But I still bet you do good with the fish guys. You're like, the waves were a foot. They were 7 feet if they were a foot. And they're like, we like this guy. He's been out on the water before. Don't screw him. No, but now I'm just going to mention some places you've worked before. And, you know, if you have anything, of course, I'm always interested if you've learned anything key, like the key thing you took away from it. But also if there are other ones that you don't want to talk about, that's fine. I've learned to say that. So you came and you started working at Markham. Was that your first New York City restaurant experience?
Yeah, I worked at the Markham in, I think, 1993. So I think I was more interested in what happened after work then, because I was 20 years old, and what was going on during work.
And then Blue Hill?
Blue Hill. I opened Blue Hill. I met Dan actually at La Seagull in 96. He was the chef there, but he's really running kind of his catering business out of that kitchen. And it was
This is down in New York West Village, right?
Yeah, it was on Mott Street. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, a really adorable little restaurant, but it was owned by, I think the woman was like 22 at the time, so it was one of those New York restaurants that was small and it was sexy, but none of the bills were getting paid. We had to go to Astor Wine to get, you know, wine. You didn't have any of the food that was actually on the menu. And you just kind of, you know, good lessons there is, like, you were winging it every night, and some of the customers appreciated it, and then, you know, eventually it just couldn't keep up.
Gramercy Tavern?
Gramercy is just a machine.
What years were you there?
I was there right after 2001.
Okay, so who was the chef there?
Well, Tom was still the chef, but he was busy with Kraft, so there was kind of an exodus. You know, he took a lot of the good cooks to Kraft, and then, you know, John Schaefer was the chef, and he was Tom's right-hand man forever, so the food didn't change and the quality didn't change, and that thing was... you learn about just efficiency, like that... If you have a good system, you can make up for a lot of bad cooks.
It's interesting. Yeah, Danny Meyer, he's definitely very successful. So so then you come to your place, and, you know, when you had eaten at all, I mean, worked at all these great places and been around New York, so you're like, did you feel there was a void to fill food-wise? Or was it more just bringing that delicious food to a different neighborhood? Like, what inspired you to get into a whole... You know, the difficulty, the huge task of opening and running a restaurant.
I wasn't smart enough to think about all that. I think I just wanted to be my own boss. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty naive, and I thought, you know, I've been living in this neighborhood long enough, and I've been in New York 20 years, and before I leave New York, I want to give it a go. So I just gave it a go. It was coming off of some pretty decent success, I thought, as a chef. And had a little momentum, and then 2008 hit, and, you know, I believed what people told me, that they were gonna, that they would back me, and that the money was gonna show up, and I started building Rye. And the reason it looks the way it is because nobody showed up with money, so it was me.
It actually became nicer.
Yeah, it was just me renovating. You know, I didn't have any money, so I couldn't do any of that nice modern construction. So I just was there every day refurbishing and pulling up all the floors. I did all the demo myself, and was dumpster diving, and a lot of our partitions are built with, you know, old doors that were pulled out, that I literally pulled out of dumpsters, and
oak columns.
Yeah, well, the bars, it took me 3 months to strip that bar. I mean, that is all quartz on oak, and the bar top's all mahogany, and I mean, that thing's 100 years old, and the building's 100 years old, and you know, people are weird with period pieces. They're like, oh, you built a period piece. It's not that at all. It's a restoration project, and this thing's out there and nobody's using it, and it's beautiful, and I think it's probably an old Dutch building, brick building. It's housed in a beautiful, what used to be a factory, where South First and South Second Street were all factories, you know, all tenant mm-hmm. factories back in the day, and you just you try to have a little pride in history and try to, you know, make a restaurant that you feel comfortable and that you would be proud of, and maybe your parents would want to sit in. And you know, Rye is, you know, you say you have to button up, but we have $5 double cheeseburgers, you know, for every happy hour, and we serve a lot of entrees for under $16. So we try to be neighborhood friendly and
yeah. Well, I know you are neighborhood friendly because the Roberta's managers meetings happen at Rye. I realize so. That's if Vanessa and those guys are going over there, that's a good sign that you're part of the neighborhood. I also like that it's a big restaurant. I mean, I say big. I mean, to me, it's big. It's a place where you can get. There's different energies. The back is a different energy than the front, and then the bar is its own energy. It's not just one tight space. So yeah, it's the luxury of being in Brooklyn. You have a lot more room. So that's impressive. So it took you how long to build the place to look like that from when you first got the spot?
It took over a year.
Over a year. And then you did this all with your general manager. She's been with you every step of the way, huh?
Well, she was. I don't know about the building process, but she was always a part of it, and we worked together at another restaurant, and so she was going to be the face of the place, you know, and I was going to be stuck in the back.
And now you're building again in the basement, so what's the goal for that spot? I got to see it, and it looked really cool.
That was the idea for the whole, you know, when I saw the spot, that was always the idea. That's why I built it the way I did it, with the garden and the entrances, and, you know, I filed for that basement when I thought that I had money coming and drew it up. You know, 5 years later, just trying to, like, you know, get to it, just getting to it now. But I think it's going to be more of a late night place and bar food and nothing over $16 maybe, you know, a little more fun.
Yeah. Keep that scotch egg down there, though. Hopefully that will be...
Maybe we'll do some quail scotch eggs so you can just pop them right in your mouth.
Yeah, don't even have to wait. Use the fork. So what about... it's interesting, you're a guy who does all this stuff. So do you just find yourself constantly in charge of every single aspect of the restaurant? Or do you delegate now after these years? Because I run Heritage, and basically I don't delegate. I mean, there are many things I don't do, but I'm also meeting with those people a few times a day and... Just, hey, what's up? How's it going? Dude, you got an email? I mean, how do you deal with the delegation thing?
That sounds like a luxury. Just like you said, we're still tiny. I mean, and I have five people in the kitchen. I'm in the kitchen every day. I'm in the front every day. You delegate what you can, but I don't have the resources. You know, I don't have the resources to bring people in. I have to do everything myself. Every dollar has gone back into Rye. You know, I put... like you said, I was a fisherman, and I worked in kitchens, so I opened Rye with all my own money. We have no other investors, so I got a loan from a credit union, and my parents helped me out by putting their house up, you know. So we've been, like, scraping every step of the way, and we're kind of continuing that. I mean, the fact that I'm building downstairs is crazy because I haven't even started paying myself for the upstairs yet.
No, that commands respect. It's a very cool place. I recommend that anyone, when they come to New York, you know, eat at Rye. And its website is ryerestaurant.com. Cal, thanks for coming in. I hope you come in again, and I will surely be coming back to your place. I think the radio guys are going to want to meet there, too, when they need to get out of the office. So thanks for being on.
Thanks so much.
So stay tuned for another restaurant I have great respect for, which I also went to for the first time in a long time, Hadley Schmidt of Northern Spy, a critically acclaimed restaurant. So we're going to talk to him. This is a great show. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Onion's Milk by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Oh,
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
The sweet voice of Brian Kenny of the Hearst Ranch. Well, we've got Hadley Schmidt in from Northern Spy Food Company. Welcome, Hadley.
Hello.
Northern Spy Food Company is named after one of New York State's classic heirloom apples. You are the executive chef there. So just to give contextualize where this is in the East Village, right, way over on 6th Street?
12th off Avenue A.
And the restaurant's design incorporates as much kind of reclaimed and repurposed materials as possible. Kind of describe to our people who've never been there, like kind of what it looks like in there. And I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Country, you know, kind of a little bit of a country feel, but I mean, the best example I can give are the tables. Just something I didn't realize for a couple months. Even the main table I work on all day long, it's bowling alley. It's an old bowling alley from somewhere that they grabbed, you know, cut the slabs, finished, and all of our tables have those little markers, little black arrows
on where you should be putting
where
the ball.
You should be putting the ball, exactly.
Very cool. So now, what is the cuisine trying to do there? I mean, they put a lot of attention. I mean, I was looking at the website. I mean, all the purveyors are mentioned in detail and this and that. I mean, tell us about what people will experience when they go there.
It's all along the lines of that sustainable movement. You know, it's pushed down our throats. You know, some people are annoyed by it, but it's all about responsibility and just having, you know, having that sustainable mindset. So it starts there. That's kind of why the dining room is set that way, and the food, you know, it's all part of what we do there. So it's all market driven, and it starts there. And, you know, when we start the menu, it's just what's available. And kind of start the market and go from there.
And is the local a thing? Because, I mean, sometimes local foods, like during certain seasons, you know, a chef will want something from a fish from Hawaii or anything like that. I mean, do you guys put kind of like a mileage barrier on what you guys need to do? Or, I mean, how does that work?
There's no set rule. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't know. I'm kind of just – It's the market that really kind of sparks what we do, you know, inspiration-wise. But ultimately, to answer that, it's more we want to work with like-minded people that produce things the right way. And, to, mm-hmm. and you know, it's part of that slow food, movement, which obviously –
Yeah,
you know a lot about.
And
so
Sage went to Vassar. It's also part of the Vassar thing.
Yeah,
you know, they kind of like help the world while still taking pleasure in it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that could be the mantra right there. So it's, you know, we pull stuff from down in Virginia, some hams, and guys that make really really beautiful aged ham and stuff, and you know, it's East Coast and it's not super close, and they, you know, they ship it up to us, mm-hmm. but. You know, it's all about people that take pride in their product. And the closer people that take pride in their product, the better. But ultimately, you know, we want great product from the like-minded people. That's more of our philosophy there.
And what do you do to those products? Like Alice Waters will claim that 90% of cuisine is agriculture, you know, and that they just have to, like, put a little sea salt on it and, like, just heat it up or something like that. You've worked at all these places, and we're going to talk about them kind of one by one like we did earlier with Cal. But what do you try to do? What do you try to do to your food that maybe is a little different? I mean, is it the quality of the source, or is it – because some of your dishes are complicated, but they don't taste complicated, right? You put a lot of effort into those dishes.
That's from the consumer's point of view. I'm glad. That's a great compliment, so thank you. But, it's certainly a little more – I don't know. I'm more like a 70-30 than a 90% guy maybe. So I don't know. Who knows? But – it's kind of the same premise though, is we're looking for the great quality, and just lately, like asparagus just started this week for us. It just popped up at the market, and I see when I shop at Whole Foods for myself, I see the asparagus from Peru the last a month ago. I don't. It's amazing how much fresher and crisper, and it snaps so much better. And that's where the local comes in. It's just so much better. So
yeah. So tell me about these places you worked and what you most learned at each place, like towards your craft and towards being the executive chef at Northern Spy. So you started at Union Pacific.
Yeah. I mean, started back in Colorado and then moved to New York to kind of take my restaurant schooling. And Union Pacific, it was my first place. And
that was kind of like in the spirit of like Rick Moonen's place and Oceana, right? And
certainly a big fish house, yeah. I really was attracted just to the vibe and like the energy of that kitchen. And we can go back through Crew and Dovetail. I mean, all of them were really influential, but that was really probably the most influential to me as a young cook, just setting the tone for my career.
Those guys were doing in the kitchen to the fish?
It's not even the food. It's just,
organization.
It's just the mindset that you develop and the energy and the passion. I mean, I learned so much about food, but I feel it just really set the tone for me to get the building blocks. And now as I move on, you start thinking about food your whole career. I mean, that's all you're thinking about. But really, there's this background of just that really set the tone for me in New York, it's tough to really explain. But
what is this? What happens vibe. When? What is that place? I actually don't know that.
So
place.
Yeah, Dovetail. We opened as a sous chef there with John Fraser, and I was there for 2 years and left. Kind of do some traveling and kind of think about my next step. And when I got back to New York, John's is a good friend now and approached me. I'm doing a pop up. I'm doing this pop up restaurant is what he said. So down in Soho area, and he got a space. And within 2 months, we opened a pop up like a 9 month pop up theme where we just changed every month. We do a different theme. Month one was kind of a Nordic in the middle. We opened in January, so it was the middle of the winter, kind of Nordic cold cuisine. And we went on to like a different theme. So New Orleans was a theme, and kind of specific, like New Orleans jazz 1920s. Mm-hmm. So we kind of tried to hit an era. And so to give an example of the New Orleans,
I hope you used Red Wattle pig for that, because that was the pig of New Orleans, for like centuries.
We had a lot of pig. I don't know.
That's fine. I'm sure it was still good.
Just to give you the grasp of the whole thing, as New Orleans, the servers, depending on the month, would have a different kind of uniform or costume, really. The dining room got redecorated. The music got updated. They'd hire somebody. For month one, we had a composer who composed his own music.
Wow.
And then different months, people would just put different soundtracks and together for the And then the kitchen, of course, the main part, we do a different menu, so all Cajun, Creole kind of food. Then we did France in France, I can't even remember, but based on a French impressionist painting period, and a lot of French food and French decor 1 month. So a lot of fun, a lot of hard work you change the whole menu at once every month.
Hmm.
So a really a great challenging progress project, a lot of fun.
So now, did you always know you wanted to be in a kitchen and in food, like growing up? Where did you grow up, in Colorado?
Colorado, yeah.
So did you just always, how did you first know that food? Because, some people are like, I want to be a baseball player. Other people want to be a lawyer. I mean, how did that hit you, or was it just an opportunity?
I think a couple of people I've heard it. You just kind of fall into this job. It's always the joke. We made the joke before we even started the show. Is like, talk. Somebody's interested in food. Let's talk them out of it. It's don't do it. My older sister worked in the local restaurants, and she's a couple years older than me. And when I was 15, it's like time to get a job. hey, sis, can you help me get a job? And mm-hmm. so I started working at the restaurant, bussing tables, and then, hey, we need help in the kitchen, mm-hmm. jump into the kitchen, and then, kitchens are turning over quickly. You find yourself moving up quickly, and you need to start thinking more about food. You start buying some cookbooks. You start like, I really like what I'm doing. I'm really interested, and you just keep going. So
now you're in charge, and you get to start your own, run your own team. I mean, how's the kitchen work? You have the Grand Manger and the meat guy. I mean, how do you do it? I mean, I saw you up there really doing a lot of the work.
We're small, and probably one of definitely the smallest restaurants seat-wise I've ever worked in. So that's a blessing and a curse. I'm really involved all the time and that's great. I like to be, and that's how you kind of develop your team, the cooks around you. Is you're involved, you're in the kitchen a lot, and I want to be in the,
So how do you take their ideas how is it? Is it rigid? I mean, are you guys joking around back there? Like,
there's a time to joke, and
people can see you. That's the thing.
Yeah. I don't know. What was your impression?
No, it seemed very, it seemed like it was going quick. That's why I say the dishes seemed somewhat intriguing. I mean, everyone liked it. My friend Toby, who's not a food person at all, he's mm-hmm. I'm the best man at his wedding. I'm talking at his thing, and he's just, I've always hated how little a food guy he was. But he went to your place, and he was like, wow, this is delicious. I got to bring my mom. Like, in a weird way, it got to him, and cool. I didn't know quite what it was. But it was serious back there. I mean, a lot of stuff was going on.
Yeah, service is pretty serious. There's a time, really, at the end of the day to kind of reflect, joke around with everybody, but when you're a small crew and it gets busy, I mean, you just kind of got to have your get your head on and focus, and that's what service is.
And now tell me about that creative moment. I mean, do you go to a place in Queens, a Thai restaurant, and taste something and be like, oh, or do you wake up one morning or in the shower and you're like, wait, would these two ingredients go well together? What if I did this? Like, how does that kind of creative moment happen in the kitchen for you guys?
Creativity is like, there's some of that. There's some of the shower moments. It's like one part, just having the mindset, opening your eyes to anything at any point in your day, and just, walking down the street or going to a Thai restaurant and having a lettuce wrap. And then I'll go and I'll be at the farmer's market, and Lonnie's farm will have these little baby heads that form. I mean, you pull them apart and they're little scoops, and it's like lettuce wrap. Let's do it. We have some pork jowl at the restaurant, mm-hmm. and let's stuff it. And we got some red turnips we pickled the other day, and let's put those in there. And there it is. It's a little snack for customers. It's a little lettuce wrap. So it's one part. I mean, just kind of observing, and there's, I always, I really read this interview with Laurent Gras, the chef, and he said, I'm inspired by beauty. I mean, what inspires you? People always ask you that. What inspires you? And he says, I'm inspired by beauty. And that's like, yeah, of course, anything, and you, anything that's beautiful on you. I'm looking at your iPhone. It's just it's an amazing little device. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
We came up with that. Yeah. and I mean, I don't know if that draws, somehow it might draw me to something, but so there's one part of just like being inspired by anything that you come across. But then the other part, that's part one, but it's one part that, and just you can be in the shower and come up with something. But the other part is you just got to be working. You just get in the kitchen. I can sit there, I can look, and I can write down an idea. But it's the other part is you're just in the kitchen and you're working, and you see, I walked, we had, like I said, we had asparagus the first time this week, and we're kind of putting the dish together with a fried egg, kind of like a scotch egg, actually. And I walk in the walk-in, and we have this tub with some horseradish, which has been there for over a month. It's holding up fine. It's like, boom, horseradish. Mm-hmm. You're just kind of working, and things just start to come together.
Is there any foods that are just not pretty? Like, no matter how hard you try, it's going to look like shit on the plate? Because I studied in medieval, I said medieval food traditions, and everything looked like someone took a shit on the plate. I mean, it's just the way they ate, I guess, and the consistency of their things. Or things would be in a pie, and then inside the pie, things would look like shit. But I mean, are there certain things that just can't be held together and can't be made pretty? Because, of course, food has to look pretty, right? That's a big thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm picky. I feel like I'm telling cooks half the night, that looks like shit. Come on, guys, let's get this, like, tighten it up. But
is there like a pudding or just something like with beets in it, or I don't know, or do you always have to beautify any energy, any creative energy? Does it always have to?
You don't serve it if it looks like shit.
Yeah, really? I mean, even
man,
though
it tastes good, goulash tastes great. Like, you just don't put it on a plate.
You don't put it on a plate. It has to look pretty.
I don't know. I mean, it's tough for you to put me on the spot on that one. So what? I feel like if you came and you were working next to me and you asked me the inspiration question in the same question, I could rattle off a bunch of things that look like shit. But yeah, I mean, the thing with goulash is just the best you can do is kind of get some chives on top of it and make it pop a little bit.
So you change your menu all the time, right? Because you're always going with the seasons. Do you guys do the same thing at Rye? I mean, are you constantly a market-driven restaurant? Or aren't all restaurants market-driven? Or how does that work with you? How do you perceive that whole thing?
Well, I think now you have to be.
Yeah.
You can't not be market-driven. And the growing season in New York is so short that... you know, we're not a California restaurant, but California kind of always sets the trend food-wise, I think. And New Yorkers like to think that, you know, we're the ones that are avant-garde and we're coming up with everything new. But, you know, we have our growing season starts with ramps, and they say March, but you don't get them until April. And then ends in September. You try to stay as local as possible. Like he's saying, he gets, you know... some nice animals from Virginia. I mean, you try to stay, I always try to stay on the East Coast when it comes to fish, and I try to get my tomatoes, you know, in the summertime, and you know, your soft shell crabs, and you stay as local and as seasonal as possible. And you want to get the best product on the plate, and I think that's what, you know, he's talking about when he says like-minded people. I mean, I don't have a problem with if product is available across the country, using the best product that we have by really intelligent people that are doing great things. We have the ability to get it. One of the great things about New York is you can get almost anything here. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's a smart, friendly, intelligent product that's good, then why not serve it?
That's Cal Elliott from Rye Restaurant. So do you at Northern Spy have higher food costs than at the other restaurants? I mean, do you tolerate more energy going towards food payments because of the mission?
No. Our food cost is generally in good shape, very good shape. I mean,
restaurants shoot for? I mean, not to reveal yours. I mean, the average restaurant.
Oh, industry-wise, you want to be under 30%.
So you can spend 30% on food?
Yeah, pretty much.
And that includes alcohol and any ingredient?
No, there's a beverage cost, which also, you know, you want to keep around 30. And that's separate. But yeah.
Does that include the labor to make that food?
No, your labor costs too.
Okay. So it's just the 30%. I find that fascinating for our listeners. You know, we're all in the sustainable, or, you know, we're in the cutting edge of the restaurant world, but a lot of people out there don't know that. I read Joe's book, Restaurant Man, because the writer for my book, my co-writer, co-wrote that book. And I learned all this stuff in that first chapter. I was like, oh, wow, so this is how it works. But 30%, and if you go over 30, you have to just charge a lot. I mean, if you're over 30, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately, at the end of the day, we're a business, you know. Yeah. We're there to make money, so, I mean...
Are they worried about the bottom line, those guys? I mean, are they tough, or are you tough on yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm tough on myself about it. And actually, they're not... Compared to other places, I've never been in a situation... Some of my friends tell me that it's like you sit down every Monday to a staff meeting and they're like, why is your food cost 0.5% up? Explain yourself. I've never been in that situation. The owners I have are great, and if it goes up a little bit, even if it does, I rarely hear about it. But I've heard about it once in my year and a half that it went up, and it was an easy conversation, and we were able to bring... I mean, it's we're in business, and we're there to make money, but they do a great job of balancing that we're doing it the way we want to do it, which is, you know, maybe spend a little extra money to find what we need. But
how fast do you find out? Do you know a week later or the minute you're doing it, it's already being plugged
in? I've worked
at
a restaurant where you monitor it daily. You mark how much you sold in food based on how much you bought that day. We know every week. We can look at it every week and just kind of make sure we're on track, and which we generally are, and that's
it. I wish Heritage Foods was like that. It takes me 4 months. I just still don't know how we did the first quarter. So I've learned to become a great reader of the pulse of the organization because I don't get the financials.
Well, ultimately, yeah, you got to like...
It's a different kind of business.
Yeah, but we look at it, ultimately, it is kind of like you look at it quarterly. Because some weeks... we do events. There's always a lot of activity. We do events.
That'd be funny. They look back and they're like, "What happened in March?" You're like, "Oh yeah, ramps."
Kind of, yeah. It's kind of true.
What happened in June? Oh right, it was wild salmon season.
We do events where we stop serving the regular menu and we do like a themed, almost like a What Happens When thing. So we did like a beef dinner at the end of the winter, where we did basically a tasting menu, $75, and you book the restaurant, and we just serve 6 courses of different beef. And we got in some really nice from upstate dry-aged beef that was quite a huge invoice for us. And that one hit right on that week, I know our food cost jumped up, but then you kind of make up the difference slowly after. So, you know, sometimes it's a little high, but as long as... That's what monitoring it is every week. You monitor and then you make sure, it evens itself out by the end of the quarter or whatever.
You can make those pork buns. I don't know. Is that scalable? Because those pork buns, I mean, there's not an American at any gas station in the country that wouldn't put two of those away.
Yeah, that's what people are saying.
Is it scalable, though?
We
got to
get that in
it?
The frozen food section. That's what people say.
Oh, really? Well, frozen food section.
It's just kind of, it's not really, that's what we want to do with it. But it's, these things are huge. You got to get these out there. And people are like, if you go to the South and you sell these things, you're going to be famous. That's what I hear, so.
Well, my friend Mark Laudner and I were talking about scalable things. I really think it's time for there to be some competing fast food franchises. You know, it could be out of trucks or whatever, but there are restaurants now that are, you know, the pork buns or the meatball at the meatball shop or certain scotch egg and stuff. If it was scalable, totally, it would compete with the burger, especially with all the people know now about maybe how those animals were treated, that they didn't come from the best system. All of a sudden, it could be an opportunity for new farms to be providing the ground meat for things that are scalable, sure. You know. We always think about cooking at home, but fast food is what Americans want. So the slow food movement should give it to them for, you know, $8-$9 a person. That ain't too far from what people spend at McDonald's anyway. Well, this has been, you have a website. It's northernspyfoodcompany.com. I love that place because Sage went to Vassar. He's one of the owners. So you got to look out for Sage. I'm actually going to be in the quarterly, the Vassar quarterly.
Cool.
I'm like, can you Photoshop like 20 pounds off me just for all the people at Vassar not to see what's happened? What I've become. I've eaten too much. So thanks so much for being on.
Thank you.
Guys, that was a very, very interesting show. I hope to have both you guys back. Joe, I want to thank you for engineering for us and for running the station so well.
Thank you, Patrick.
All right, so stay tuned. We have 3 more shows today, right? Straight No Chaser, hosted by Katie Kiefer, then the Mike and Judy show, and then the morning after, right?
Yep, that's the schedule for today. So keep it locked on heritageradionetwork.org, everybody.
All right, brother. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with Steve Jenkins and Bonnie, who has a very bit of interesting information to reveal. Roberta's Waitress, next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.